It's 1943 and war rages around the world. American soldiers and their allies are fighting their way across Africa, and they eventually force Italy to surrender. But how can you contribute to the war effort at home?
You can have vegetables, lots of them, on your table next winter if you have your own Victory Garden. Get the advice of a garden expert if you need it, and be prepared to grow your own for victory.
I'm Jeremy Bernfeld, and today on Central Standard, we're taking a look at how government policies affect the food we eat. From World War II victory gardens, to the agriculture supports that prop up farmers, to the vital role regulators play in keeping our food safe. Plus, the Ford plant in Kansas City is getting a new plum assignment. That's coming up on Central Standard after this hour's news. Now, let's talk a little about food. Try as we might, Americans can't seem to get Uncle Sam out of our kitchens. Government policies have a hand in just about everything we buy, cook, and eat. A new exhibit at the National Archives in Kansas City puts all of this into focus. It's called What's Cooking Uncle Sam? And it's at the National Archives building here in Kansas City. The traveling exhibit was first shown in Washington, D.C., and it chronicles the history of government policies that affect the food we eat. So now I want to bring in one of the curators of the exhibit. Dee Myers is an exhibition specialist. I'm sorry, Dee Harris is an exhibition specialist at the National Archives in Kansas City. So thanks so much for coming in, Dee.
Thanks for having me, Jamie.
And now that I've got your name right, especially, I'm so glad you're here. So, Dee, can you tell us a little about this exhibit? It breaks everything down into four sections, all related to food. There's farm, factory, kitchen, and table. So, you know, what do we see if we head down and view the exhibit?
Well, you're going to see a lot about how the government interacts with our food production and the way we eat food. And it's an exhibit that really looks at all of the ways for the past 200 years our government has been involved with our food source. And it does look at those four categories. It starts with farm and kind of looks at how the federal government was involved in the finding of foreign seeds and foreign plants and bringing them back to our country, how they were involved with regulating farm production. Also, it looks at factory, the regulation of factory production, the 1906 Food and Drug Act. And then it goes into our kitchen and talks about how the federal government was involved, especially during World War I and World War II, with how we eat, what we eat, how much we eat, and how much we conserve. And then ends up with the table that our government sets, and that's for our kids' school lunch program, our soldiers, and then our presidents and what they eat in the White House.
So as you said, you can really get a feel for the kind of large role that the government plays in the food system here in America, and that's, you know, historically and even up to today. As far as the exhibit itself, I mean, it has research and you know, primary source documents and all of those things from both the National Archives in D.C. and from the archives here in Kansas City.
Right. The exhibit was originally curated in D.C. by Alice Camps, my colleague there in D.C., and they had a much broader look in terms of all of the records from Washington, D.C., records from all over the country at our regional archives facilities like ours here in Kansas City. And so the original exhibit was larger and included all of a lot more original documents. We have a beautifully done, smaller traveling version of the exhibit, and then we've been able to incorporate our own documents from our holdings here in Kansas City that kind of support the story.
So can you, as we said, the exhibit is focused on the things that the government has done to try to influence what Americans eat. So can you give us an example of one of those things that's highlighted in the exhibit? You know, what kind of things did the government do to change our behavior or to encourage or discourage certain foods?
Well, okay, everybody has probably been told, clean your plate. And that was one of the messages during World War I and World War II, was asking people to clean their plate and to not waste food. I remember just it being my dad who told me to always clean my plate. We always had to do that growing up. But what I realized is by understanding the stories that focus that the government has had in terms of trying to control the food sources in some ways, that this really was a message that was coming out from the federal government during World War II. And that's where my dad learned it. And it wasn't just dad being, you know, hard on us and making us clean our plate. It was something that he had been been taught through this propaganda effort by the government during World War II.
So ingrained within us, and even, you know, through long roots of that.
Absolutely.
So I want to just briefly touch on one of my favorite parts of the exhibit. You know, I'm not going to say that I'm a rebel. I am a public radio reporter, after all. But if I ever do go to federal prison, it will definitely be for a crime that is much worse than selling margarine. But that actually happened, right? I mean, gangsters were put in prison for selling margarine, and it happened out here. You have some of the documents, the prison records of these crimes here in Missouri and Kansas. So can you tell us a story about these margarine gangsters?
Absolutely. These poor guys were sent to a maximum security prison for crimes against butter. In the late 1800s, the margarine industry began to rise, and the butter industry, of course, was very concerned with this fake butter that was being put out on the market. And so they were able to successfully lobby the United States government and get an act passed, the Margarine Act of 1886, that taxed margarine and butter substitutes at a much higher rate than butter was being taxed. And so you have the beginnings of this bootleg industry then, just like, you know, when liquor was outlawed, we had all these bootleg liquor distributors. Well, we began having bootleg margarine distributors. And so because they didn't pay their federal taxes on this bootleg margarine or bootleg butter, they were actually arrested, and it was a federal offense. And so they were sentenced. We have over 50 individuals that served time in Leavenworth between 1911 and 1917 for crimes against butter.
Terrible, terrible crimes.
Right.
Kansas City, I want to hear from you and call us here at Central Standard. What role do you think the government should play with our food? So please join the conversation. You can call us here, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. And for now, I want to bring in another guest now to the show. John Herron is an associate professor and chair of the history department here at UMKC. John, thanks for coming on Central Standard.
You're welcome, Jeremy. Thanks for having me here.
So, John, when we think of big changes in the American diet, we think often of the world wars. The wars were seismic events in our history, and especially in our food history. They changed what we eat, how much we eat, how we prepare food. Isn't that right?
Correct. I think one thing that we need to remember is that when the government is trying to prepare a nation for war, the first things we think about are military preparedness, getting our soldiers ready, getting munitions ready. But just as important is getting the home front ready. And in this case, it meant control of and regulation of America's food supply.
So you talked about control and regulation. I mean, the rationing is something that we immediately think of when we think of those things. It was a huge part of the war effort during both World War I and World War II. You know, I'm sure plenty of our listeners remembered what that was like. But, John, can you tell me about the rationing programs maybe during World War I?
Yeah, World War I probably a little bit more than World War II. So the United States made a great effort during the war to conserve food and other important materials, not only to help supply our troops, but to help our allies abroad. So people were encouraged to follow very catchy slogans, meatless Mondays or wheatless Wednesdays, in an effort to both, again, unite the general public behind the war effort and fulfill or furnish these essential resources to all of these allied nations. To facilitate the process, the United States Food Administration was established by Woodrow Wilson. It was headed by future President Herbert Hoover. And in all of these pamphlets that Hoover and his administration blanketed the country, sweets without sugar and how to live without wheat and the potato possibilities. Basically, it was a federal effort to show American housewives in particular how they could live without the regular food that was being rationed at the time.
And Dee, that's kind of where this exhibit comes in. I mean, you have tons of, these primary sources, or it's almost like going back into a time machine and seeing the PSAs and seeing the propaganda posters, and they're all at this exhibit, right?
They are. We have a great collection here in Kansas City of the Food Administration records from the time of the World War I and World War II. And I pulled a selection of records from our local holdings that really do focus on that conservation effort. And one of my favorite pieces in this exhibit is the photographs of the Patriots. They were Patriot Potatoes. That it was this exhibit that had been created by the Food Administration to encourage people to eat potatoes, as John just mentioned. And they were supposed to be eaten uniform and all. Because, of course, the skin is the uniform of the potato, and the skin is where the nutrients were. And really, World War I and World War II is where we see the role of nutrition and vitamins coming into the diet in terms of looking at what we're eating and the quality of the food.
Well, so that was my next question. I mean, how did these wars, or say, how did the rationing in World War I change the American dinner plate kind of moving forward? In the wake of the wars, what changed in American eating habits? Do we have examples of that, John?
First of all, the foods, like Dee was mentioning, so were Americans eating potatoes before World War I? Yeah, certainly, of course. But during the war and after the war, thanks to rationing and thanks to sort of food plans that the federal government put together, the federal government basically stabilized, simplified, sort of organized the American diet in ways that sort of reflect some of the legacies of the wars. So potatoes, which were popular, become ubiquitous in America. My favorite recipe from the Food Will Win the War campaign of the Food Administration was American chop suey, which was made with potatoes. But you would make potato bread, potato muffins, potato soups, potato cookies. Potato cookies. So did the government in kind of structure how Americans ate? Certainly, because they dictated what was going to be in the food pyramid. They determined what foods were going to become available. And once again, I think the American diet tends to simplify a little bit. It gets a little bit more uniform because of the wars.
So as I mentioned, you can call us here at 816-235-2888. And I want to get to a caller who is on the line here. Linister, hi, how are you?
Yes, hello. Let's talk about pork. There was on the farm report about 6 in the morning some odd years ago about a farmer that injured his leg, and he went to the doctor who gave him antibiotics, and the wound would not heal. It turned out he's given antibiotics to his pigs. And so since he's eating his own pig meat, that affected his system and the use of antibiotics. He stopped giving his pigs antibiotics, and he turned them loose in the field, and then he sold them at Heritage Pork and made more money doing that. So I don't eat pig meat today. I'm afraid of it.
So I think, maybe you're kind of getting at, Linister, and correct me if I'm wrong, but kind of the government's role in regulating things like antibiotics or other additives, the farm production. And I think we have a long history of that. So let me pose that to our guests. We have more regulation today, certainly, but that has deep roots. Isn't that right, Dee? I mean, we're talking about early 20th century is when a lot of these government regulation food safety efforts kind of came to be.
Right. It wasn't until 1906 that we have government regulation on the food and drug from the Food and Drug Act of 1906. And prior to that, your beef packing plants, your pork plants, those plants were not regulated, and there was not the food cleanliness, the cleanliness requirements that we have today. And there's a big scandal during the Spanish-American War about embalmed beef being sent over to our soldiers and soldiers dying from eating this canned meat that had been treated with toxic chemicals to keep it, supposedly to preserve it, and that it didn't work, and these soldiers ate it and they died, and more soldiers died from the food than from being killed in action. And so there's a lot of stories about that. And of course, our Kansas City plants here with the Food and Drug Act became increasingly under inspection by 1906.
And I mean, even today, we depend on the government to ensure that our food is safe. And there are really roots of that. As you said, 1906 was the start of that.
Right. And, a lot of questions about the act in 1906. But since then, we've had so many changes within the act. But it's not until 1965 that requirements for knowing what is in a product were put on product labeling. So even that, there's, 60 years there of the American public not knowing what they were eating.
Well, and food products we now take for granted, like canned meat, or ketchup, were in fact quite dangerous at the time of the Industrial Revolution. So, why was that, and how did regulations change some of that?
Well, those foods at the time of the Industrial Revolution were dangerous because the producers, the factory owners, they could put anything in those products that they wanted to stabilize the product and make it appear safe. And so you have toxic chemicals being used to make ketchup more appetizing visually, but you know these products are injuring people and making people sick. And in some cases, we have toxic candy being sold in Nebraska in the early 1900s that some children died from eating candy. So, you know, certainly there was a lot of work prior to that to get to this point of the Food and Drug Act. But and part of that is government studies and government. We have the poison squad of Dr. Wiley.
Yeah, can you tell us about the story of the poison squad? You know, what was it and how did it affect food regulation in this case?
Certainly. Dr. Wiley was hired by the federal government to do some testing on food additives and things like, you know, boric acid that were being put, chemicals that were being put into food supplies. And so he actually hired men who were willing to eat increasing amounts of food with some of these standard chemicals in them. And then he measured the toxic levels and the results of these foods, and was dubbed the poison squad by the journalists of the day. But it was really successful in understanding what these food additives were doing to people and allowing people to understand what was in their food.
And so these men would eat kind of knowingly toxic food.
Yes, they signed on knowing that this food was toxic.
My gosh. And then from what I can tell from the exhibit, it kind of captured the imagination of journalists and really the country. And that helped spur a lot of this regulation.
It did. This is 4 years before the Food and Drug Act was put into place. And so it was very important for us to understand what that process was. And just 4 years later, after this advertisement, we had the Food and Drug Act.
We're going to take a break, and when we return, we'll continue our conversation with Dee Harris and Dr. John Herron about the history of government's effect on our diet and our food choices. Central Standard returns in just a moment.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM, KCUR, Kansas City, online at kcur.org. Kansas Governor Sam Brownback will give the annual State of the State speech tonight, which will be followed by the Democratic response. Live coverage, courtesy of Kansas Public Radio, begins tonight at 6:30 on KCUR. And coming up this morning on Up to Date, ethics reform legislation with the Missouri Secretary of State, plus 90 Mile View and more. Stay with us for Up to Date, coming up this morning at 11. Central Standard is made possible in part by the Confucius Institute at the University of Kansas in Overland Park, offering evening and weekend classes for everyone in conversational Chinese language. Classes begin January 25th. Early registration information is online at confucius.ku.edu. It's 10:35, 21 degrees in Midtown Kansas City. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR.
Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jeremy Bernfeld. Today we're talking to Dee Harris, she's an exhibit specialist at the National Archives at Kansas City, and Dr. John Herron, Associate Professor of History at UMKC. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about the role government has played in food production and consumption here in the U.S. throughout our history. You know, at the top of the show, we heard a PSA from 1943 urging people to plant victory gardens to support the troops. Dee, the exhibit at the National Archives showcases a lot of the PSAs and propaganda the government used to change American eating habits. Food policy was really part of national security, both in feeding the troops who are actually at war, but also here at home. John, you know, poorly fed kids don't become strapping soldiers, right?
That's true. Matter of fact, the school lunch program, which emerges from the United States Department of Agriculture, is a byproduct of World War II. So food becomes very political both at home and abroad. So you definitely want you definitely want strong young men to serve in the armed forces, but you also want to sort of spread the value of American food globally. We see right before World War II, we see the United States Department of Agriculture produce all these eating guides. And those eating guides include calorie counts, but the it's not the way we would think of calorie counts today in terms of keeping your calorie count low. It's the government trying to get families to recognize that they need to keep the calorie count high. So you need to know how much you're feeding your children so that they grow up big and strong. And so the federal government was very involved in making sure that Americans got enough nutrition. But very soon, those same government administrators recognized that when the rest of the world is starving, when Russia is starving and India is starving, that you could use American food as a political tool to try to convince these, you know, citizens of the world that the American system, you know, has great value.
So food almost as a carrot or even a stick, I would imagine, you know, taking away kind of food aid, and that's still done today.
Yeah, this actually begins in World War I when Herbert Hoover gives food aid to Russia. He is vilified in the papers. It's like, why are you giving, you know, American food to the Bolsheviks? Publicly, he would say, well, listen, these are humans. They're starving to death. We need to do this. But privately, he would tell his aides that what I'm doing is trying to convince these people to where there exists hunger, there exists revolution. And if we can use American food to stop that revolution, then all the better. This goes through American relationships with all of the Eastern Bloc countries, our allies in the West. And we see it this with India in particular. Lyndon Johnson has a food program during the Vietnam War to try to convince our Asian friends and enemies that this is the way to go. And often these food aid packages came with strings.
Of course, yeah, naturally. Well, we've got another caller here. Let's get to Grover. Hi, Grover.
Good morning. My comment is I've seen Soil Service, the conservation program, drive us to a mono, plant program where it's either corn or soybeans, where, you know, it used to be, you know, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, we were able to grow everything on the farm and supply it locally. Well, now we're, you know, because of soil conservation, we now have biogenically engineered products, and we do chemicals and things of that nature. That demand that we grow one crop because, you know, it's so much more economical and feasible to do it that way than try and grow, you know, 14 different products on your farm. So I think Soil Service has been, you know, much more influential on a world basis even than any of the other programs that I can think of.
I think you're absolutely right, Grover, and I think a lot of that is seen both in the exhibits and in some of the things that we've been talking about. There are two things I'm curious about that's related to Grover's question. One, D, you know, the U.S. government has played a role in encouraging or discouraging farmers to plant certain things for a long time, and that's something that we see in this exhibit. So I'll get to that. And then also, John, I'd love to hear how it seems to me like that may be a remnant of some of the things we've talked about with the world wars. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. And I mean, the United States Department of Agriculture goes back. That was Abraham Lincoln, I mean, signed that into law in 1862. It becomes a cabinet position in the 1880s. And all of the things that we'd associate with the Department of Agriculture, I mean, they've got a wide-ranging list of activities, rural housing, electricity, credit service. But most of their activities revolve around food, in particular things like agriculture experiment stations and cooperative extension societies and the Soil Service that the caller was mentioning. And certainly I don't want to say the federal government is blameless in this transition, this agriculture transition that Grover was talking about, but he nailed it at the end. These are sort of market forces. These are economies of scale that have come into American agriculture or world agriculture that have transformed the way Americans sort of get their food. We've gone from, you know, an American nation that was all agriculture to now, I think the latest figure I saw from the Department of Agriculture is less than 0.5% of Americans are farmers now. So, and this changes the way the market operates.
That's absolutely true. And talk about a long legacy. I mean, just to get in a quick plug, Harvest Public Media, based here at KCUR, covers these kinds of issues a lot. So if anyone is more interested in these kinds of issues, do go to harvestpublicmedia.org. I did have to get that plug in there. But Dee, kind of what John was mentioning, I mean, there's a lot that the story of the exhibit here and the story of a lot of the research that it brings to the fore is about how the U.S. government deals with a population that was at one point, say, 98% farmers, and now it's about 1% farmers. And there's a lot in there about that.
Absolutely. And that's actually the first part of the exhibit in the farm section, where we really look at how the government has been involved in the farming industry. And as early as 1839, the U.S. Patent and Trade Office began to distribute free seats to farmers. And they went through their congressional representatives at that point. And in as late as 1897, 1.1 billion packets of seeds were distributed free to farmers across the nation. And the goal there was to distribute these seeds that in some cases were unusual varieties, unusual strains that have been gathered from other countries, to try and encourage stronger, superior plants to be planted, and to encourage diversification in crops, as well as, you know, finding out what's the best crop that's going to grow in this particular area. And these farm experiment stations that were established by the federal government were critical in that respect as well.
Grover, thank you so much for your call. And one thing that, Dee, I loved seeing in the exhibit, I read that Thomas Jefferson smuggled seeds from Italy, I believe it was, into the U.S.
Yes, I mean, it was a capital punishment crime to be caught with smuggling seeds out of your pocket.
And then that's how our agriculture system started. I mean, John, as you said, there's a long history of the U.S. government in farm policy. I mean, now we think of the Farm Bill, but it goes back a long ways.
Yeah, and again, just to quick add, it's not just Thomas Jefferson, it's Benjamin Franklin, it's all the founding fathers that are traveling Europe are acting as sort of agricultural spies. Franklin was sending seeds back to his son in Philadelphia, asking him to plant this, let's see, how about this? That has a long and deep history that has continued as the federal government became more bureaucratic, from all the things we've talked about with the Pure Food and Drug Act, through the New Deal. There's a very popular, very well-known New Deal program called the Agricultural Adjustment Act, which limits production and keep prices high, price supports. All of this continues up to the present day.
You know, we have another caller, and you can be part of this conversation at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or, of course, you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Let's get to Linda. Hi, Linda.
Hello.
Do you have a question?
I do. Given the influence of biotech, big pharma, the chemical industry, how does this exhibit address their influences on the shaping of and impact of agricultural policy and food in general?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's something that I was thinking of when Dee was just talking about distributing free seeds from the government. I mean, you couldn't imagine today with such a vibrant biotech and seed industry here in the Midwest with Monsanto and DuPont Pioneer, et cetera. And I know that in the exhibit, it talks about how intense lobbying from the seed industry put a stop to that process. I mean, 1.1 billion packets of seeds to zero because of that lobbying. So, Dee, is there anything else that you can add to that?
Well, the exhibit really kind of only goes through about the 1960s and 70s, so we don't deal with the current lobbying industry today. But certainly all the way through this exhibit, it does focus on where those lobbyists, like with the butter industry, with the seed packets, I mean, it deals with those. The industry in terms of meatpacking, boy, those meatpacking plants did not want federal inspection in their plants. And so we tried this exhibit really does look at those positive and negative aspects in terms of where lobbyists have been effective, where the industry has been able to push back against federal involvement. And so I think that there are numerous ways that the exhibit looks at that very topic, although it doesn't deal with the very current issue of chemicals on fields.
Linda, thanks so much for your question.
Thank you. I look forward to the exhibit. Will you share how we can access it?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, it's at the National Archives Building in Kansas City, which is down near Union Station. It's Tuesday through Saturday, I believe, from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m.
And of course, there's a National Archives Kansas City website as well with some information, correct?
Yes. Yes. You can go to archives.gov. There's actually an exhibit online. If you go to archives.gov and put in "What's Cooking Uncle Sam," you'll see the online version of the exhibit.
Oh, and there's a lot of it. The material is digitized. You can even see some of it from home, although I would say, you know, go to the exhibit also. I would be remiss. I want to get to something that we were talking about earlier before the show started, and that's the food pyramid. You know, we all know the food pyramid that you used to. It's now out of date. Tell us how much to eat and what foods are healthy. And that actually comes from a long tradition of government research into what constitutes a healthy diet. Isn't that right, John?
Yeah. Matter of fact, I think the first food pyramid, and I don't think it was called a food pyramid then, it was a food guide, dates to the early 1890s, 1893, 1894, something like that. And it was it has been drawn and redrawn for decades. What was considered healthy, what was considered unhealthy is in constant evolution. And the food pyramids are a great way to see in microcosm what the federal government thinks is good for its citizens. And the way things ebb and flow off that chart or on that chart is really fascinating to look at.
And we can see some of those at the exhibit, D. I mean, you were saying about how you can see visually, as John said, how things have changed over the years.
Right. If you look at the food pyramid from 1945, it's not a pyramid. It's a circle. It has seven food groups, of which butter is its own food group. And I think the most important thing, and what John is alluding to here, is it says at the bottom of that poster, in addition to the basic seven, eat any other foods you want.
That's perfectly healthy.
Right, right.
If we've got butter as a wheel on the food pyramid, let's have chocolate cake as the next one, please.
Absolutely. And, you know, and so it is the federal government during World War II encouraging people to eat, encouraging our youth to grow strong, feeding our youth off of these seven categories as well. But then if you look at one from the 1990s, it's very different in terms of looking at what's healthy and what's not healthy. And then today it's a simple plate. I mean, the visual of the food pyramid is now a plate with what you're, you know, the portions of what you're supposed to eat on the plate itself. So you're right that this evolved dramatically, and I think it's very telling in terms of what our government wants us to eat.
You know, John, it's easy to see why the federal government would want such a role in determining what a healthy diet is when we're talking about in the period between World War I and II and just after World War II, in creating healthy soldiers and a healthy home front to be able to fight, literally fight these battles. But today, it's obviously a little different. I mean, you know, why should or why does the government feel it necessary to kind of still be involved in this game?
Well, much like some of our discussion about food and I think in international politics, you can look as, I mean, food in today's society is intimately wrapped up with issues of race and poverty and class. And so I think the tendency is just look at food as this sort of simple thing in our lives that we don't really give much thought to how it comes to your table. The food that we get at the market just has kind of always been in that form, when in fact there's this deep regulatory history that has influenced how Americans have eaten for 300 years. And then once again, in contemporary America, it has a lot to do with what do we expect our federal government to do in terms of how we treat our citizens. Like, is there a federal government responsibility to make sure that citizens are, in fact, healthy and safe? It's very easy to listen to the political dialogue in contemporary America and conclude that most Americans simply want the federal government out of their lives as much as possible, when, in fact, I don't really think we want that, at least in terms of food and food safety and food regulation. There are certainly sort of downsides in a couple of the callers have already talked about them, the expansion of the chemical industry in agriculture, the agribusiness, which is now sort of the dominant mode of food production in America. But without the federal government, without basic price supports, the agricultural industry fails. Without school lunches, there's a percentage of Americans who go without food. So I think there are just too many positives that if the federal government leaves this area of interest, then I think it would be trouble.
Well, and that almost, D, is the story of the exhibit. It points to, I think, kind of the ebb and flow of government's role in our food system. And I think it highlights some of the highs, say,
the poison squad really drumming up support for food regulation that keeps people safe, and also some of the lows in this as well. I mean, that really is what the exhibit is about, and to try to put it in today's role in context.
And it illustrates the so many ways that the government is involved on a daily basis in our food supply. And I think that that's one of the messages that people get from this exhibit, is just not even realizing that the school lunch that their child eats is a result of a federal government. So, you know, everybody's child has lunch at school. Well, that didn't happen until the 1940s, until World War II. And so every single way that our lives are affected by the federal government involved in our food supply.
So, you know, today, First Lady Michelle Obama has kind of picked up this mantle. You know, we're talking about the food pyramid that's now obsolete. I mean, her pet project really is changing the American diet. Instead of encouraging Americans to get more calories in the aftermath of, I think you mentioned, John, World War I, you know, the government now really is trying to get Americans to eat less, right?
Certainly, if not eat less, eat, you know, make better choices. If you remember, there was a little backlash against Obama, Michelle Obama, and her garden. And it's like, once again, it's the federal government telling us what to eat. I think it's more the federal government telling us to make informed choices. So once again, I think it's easy to sort of use a very broad brush and see the federal government involved in food practices as being too much of a big brother influence, when in fact, I think it's in fact the federal government's job to make sure that Americans aren't just, again, it's not the federal government's decision to say how much we eat, but I would want the federal government to make sure that Americans have choices and they can make the right choices, and that the choices that they're trying to, the food that they're putting into their systems, is protected and safe.
And I think it's clear that, regardless of whether we realize it, I mean, there is almost this invisible role that the government is continuing to play even today.
Oh, yeah. This goes back much further than anybody, I think, you tend to think. I mean, there are food has determined historical events. The government has involved in this since the American Revolution. The federal government has been determining food policy. But availability of food, the lack of food, historical events have turned on sort of a food story. And once again, that's just not what we are. The conventional wisdom does not support that.
You know, John mentioned the Revolutionary War, the Civil War. I mean, it dates back a long ways from the very dawn of the country here. And Dee, you have some of those things in the archives that the exhibit talks about.
We do. And actually, John's mentioned the Revolutionary War. It's interesting that, you know, at the very beginning of the Revolutionary War, and they were trying to convince people to sign up and fight for the effort, you know, a lot of colonists weren't quite motivated by those cries for freedom, but they were motivated by the promise of generous rations. And that was an incentive to enlist in a time where food was not as readily available. And knowing that the federal government was going to feed you, and I mean, it just was an incentive, and it has been incentive in times where food was scarce.
So one of the other things that I loved, a story that goes through the exhibit, was about Frank Meyer. He was kind of a U.S. government explorer. And, you know, John, you mentioned how the Founding Fathers served as kind of agriculture spies. It seems like he kind of took that through a century later, and he traveled the world trying to find crops he could bring back to America that would flourish here. So can you tell us maybe a little about his story?
Well, people might actually know Frank's name from the Meyer Lemon. He was
And he actually brought that back.
He did. He collected samples of fruit in China and brought back this particular strain of lemon, and the Department of Agriculture cultivated this strain. But Frank was an explorer, an adventurer in the early 1900s, and he went to Asia in particular, an Asian expedition from 1909 to 1911, where he was out there simply looking for foreign plants to bring back to the United States and to cultivate here locally and to mix with other strains to see what would grow best in our local climates.
John, I'm
I'm fascinated by this idea, you know, of history turning on world events, but also as far as what we eat today or what we grow today, some of the things one of our callers mentioned, you know, corn and soybeans and sugar beets, for instance, that a lot of that, what we grow here in the Midwest, kind of stems from these growing programs initiated related to the world wars and then the post-World War II economy. Isn't that?
Yeah, that's true. And again, where we're going to see the biggest explosion of these kinds of programs is in the New Deal in the 1930s. There's two sort of patches of the New Deal. There's a 1933 version. There's a 1935 version. And coming out of that big sort of alphabet soup list of programs are all these federal government initiated programs about food production. And again, the legacy of that is still with us. I would say maybe 10 or 15 years ago, for lack of a better term, food studies didn't exist. Now every major university has a department that is investigating these kinds of things, that is looking at government programs. You see this in popular books and magazines. Michael Pollan is a very popular food writer. There's documentaries about food and what we eat. And again, all of this is tied into how the federal government tries to manipulate or encourage certain food productions in America.
And that's what a lot of the documents point to. I mean, it was a real trip for me to go back and watch some of the PSAs, you know, the silent film PSAs that they had about the food system and so forth at the exhibit.
Right. And you see that either in print, you see it on radio. I mean, the World War II, we have a huge amount of radio work that is being done, that's being broadcast over the years to encourage people to either produce more sugar beets or to produce less of something else, and to really look at what the government needed at the time. And today we still see this. We're still seeing all of this propaganda that tells us what needs to be produced, what doesn't need to be produced.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time right now. I want to thank Dee Harris. She's the exhibit specialist at the National Archives at Kansas City, and Dr. John Herron, associate professor of history at UMKC. The exhibit, What's Cooking, Uncle Sam, is currently open at the National Archives in Kansas City. It's available, as I said, for viewing Tuesday through Saturday, 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Tune in tomorrow for KC Currents as we analyze the Kansas City accent. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton. Up to Date is next with Missouri Secretary of State Jason Kander. I'm Jeremy Bernfeld. This is KCUR.